Sheffield Live. Made in Sheffield, made by you.
If you like rock in all its forms, you will love Glory Days. You can listen to us locally on 93.2 FM and on the telly, and anywhere in the world on sheffieldlive.org. What do you think, Dawn? You know what? I think he likes it. That's Glory Days, every Monday 1 till 3 here on Sheffield Live. Bosh, bosh. Oops, I've had an accident.
Hello, I'm Harry Wilburn. I present Steel & Wire every Wednesday, 10 a.m. Americana, Bluegrass, American Roots, and more. Lots of guests, lots of local music and musicians. That's Steel & Wire, Wednesday, 10 a.m.
You're listening to fabulous Harry Wilburn on Steel & Wire.
It's time to open the music box. Join me, Steve Roden, every Thursday morning between 10 and 12 for music from the 40s to the 90s from my own music collection. Songs I've grown up with, ones I am sure you will enjoy hearing again. Hope to see you then.
If you love new music and you want to discover the best new artists out there, then tune into The Backroom with me, Paddy. I'll be playing the best in new indie, electro, EDM and punk and showcasing new Sheffield talent. Also music news, local and national gig guide and new album releases. So tune into The Backroom every Thursday night between 6 and 7 p.m. here on Sheffield Live, 93.2 FM.
This is Sheffield Live.
N-E-X.
Good morning. Welcome to the Live Science Radio Show here on Sheffield Live 93.2 FM on digital if you're in South Yorkshire, or sheffieldlive.org. You can listen online anywhere in the world, apparently. You can also download the podcast later and listen at your leisure. You've got Julie and Paul here live in the studio as usual this Saturday morning. It's the 18th of January 2025 if you're listening on catch up. And thank goodness most of the snow is gone and we've had a rather cold cycle in. Probably the coldest for a while. I say we've got Julie and Paul here live in the studio. We've got RPG later on. We'll have him on the telephone. We'll also be talking to Gareth Morgan.
Yeah.
Indeed, he's on every third Saturday of the month. He's a member of and ex-president of the Sheffield Photographic Society, and he'll be talking about getting your photographs seen, which is rather apt, as Sheffield Photographic Society have got an open photography competition. More of that later. Next week, and indeed every fourth Saturday of the month, all being well, it's Chris Dale. He'll be talking about ultra-processed foods, I think, but to be confirmed. Before we go any further, this Friday, the 24th of January, what starts, Paul?
It is the RSPB Big Garden Birdwatch. Take part in the UK's biggest garden wildlife survey by watching the birds for an hour between the 24th and 26th of January. Last year, more than 600,000 people participated in the RSPB organised event. Grab a cuppa and record the birds you see in your garden from your balcony or in a local park, and then log them on the RSPB website. And it's rspb.org.uk/birdwatch.
Great stuff. Yes. Before we move on to our environment update, dementia saw this nugget in the press. Swapping bacon for nuts or lentils could cut your risk of dementia by as much as 16%, new research suggests. Wow. Scientists from three Massachusetts institutions found that eating greater quantities of red meat, especially in processed forms, increase the risk for dementia as well as cardiovascular disease. So Daniel Wang, who's one of the authors of the study, said dietary guidelines tend to focus on reducing risks of chronic conditions like heart disease and diabetes, while cognitive health is less frequently discussed. Despite being linked to these diseases, we hope our results encourage greater consideration of the connection between diet and brain health.
Wow. You made it.
Indeed. So next up, this week's environment update, kicking off with climate change stuff.
Yeah, right. 2024 has been confirmed as the hottest on record globally, with temperatures rising above the 1.5 degrees Celsius warming target set by the Paris Agreement. This grim milestone is likely to bring further extreme weather events, including wildfires, heat waves and flooding, affecting billions of people across the world.
Indeed, and bumblebees have been found to be starting nests in the depths of winter due to climate change. The charity Bug Life said active worker bumblebees, which do most of the work in the nest, were spotted in Aberdeen during mild weather over the Christmas break. A previous survey had already recorded bumblebees and honeybees between Christmas and New Year at locations across the UK, including the Highlands. Now, the charity Bug Life said the nests were at high risk of failing because of the shortage of flowers for bees to collect nectar and pollen from and the likelihood of a return to colder weather.
Hundreds of acres of farmland are set to be turned into a salt marsh nature reserve on the Severn Estuary. The Wildlife and Wetlands Trust is spending £21 million on low-lying farmland in an attempt to restore lost wetlands and unlock their power to reduce flooding, store carbon and improve biodiversity.
Next, cleaner, greener fuel. A British green energy developer has drawn up plans to build one of the largest battery storage projects in Europe, capable of powering about 2.2 million homes for 2 hours. So Stratera, which is backed by the Swedish firm EQT Infrastructure, hopes that 680 megawatt battery storage system in Greater Manchester will start sending power to the grid next year.
And we move up to Norway. Norway is on the cusp of becoming the first country to fully phase out the sale of new fossil fuel cars, after electric vehicles made up almost 90% of new cars sold in 2024. Experts say that the country's approach to decarbonising has been effective because of consistent tax policies maintained by successive governments, the lack of a car-making lobby and close collaboration between politicians and the public.
Food for thought, eh? And lastly, on the environment update, sustainability. One for us all to think about. Think before you buy something new. And some examples, Berghaus replaced zips in their outdoor garments for free indefinitely. They also resold walking boots for free. Always check whether a faulty appliance is still under warranty before rushing to buy a new one, as it may be able to be repaired for free. Even if your appliance is out of warranty, it may still be much cheaper to replace a part than buying a completely new appliance. Another tip is find your local repair cafe where volunteers will try to fix a whole range of things for a small donation. And also at the same time, they will probably teach you about the repair as they do it. So all good stuff. Finally, check out the variety of items offered for free on FreeCycle where charging is not allowed.
What I want any old time. I said I'm free to do what I want any old time. I say love me, hold me, love me, hold me, 'cause I'm free to do what I want. Any old time.
We didn't actually want to turn that track off. The Soup Dragons covering I'm Free by the Rolling Stones.
I was there to turn it off.
I know.
Or
well,
down.
It is the Life Science Radio Show. We must get on and talk science. Yeah. This show is all about science in all its different forms. We're here every Saturday morning, 11 till 12, here on Sheffield Live 93.2 FM. Next up, I'm going to recap on the World Wide Web, a brief history of, because it's really quite fascinating stuff and we tend to forget about it. So Paul's going to kick off.
Yes, Professor Sir Tim Berners-Lee is a British computer scientist. He was born in London in 1955 and his parents were early computer scientists. Working on one of the earliest computers, growing up, Sir Tim was interested in trains and had a model railway in his bedroom. Tim recalls that I made some electronic gadgets to control the trains. Then I ended up getting more interested in electronics than trains. Later on, when I was in college, I made a computer out of an old television set. Hey, I like to see that. After graduating from Oxford University, Tim Berners-Lee became a software engineer at CERN, C-E-R-N, the European Organisation for Nuclear Research, which is basically a large particle physics laboratory near Geneva, Switzerland. Whilst working there, Tim noticed that they were having difficulty sharing information. Tim recalls that in those days, there was different information on different computers, but you had to log on to different computers to get at it. Also, sometimes you had to learn a different program on each computer. Often, it was just easiest to go and ask people when they were having coffee. Tim thought he saw a way to solve this problem, one that he thought could also have much broader applications. Already millions of computers were being connected together through the fast-developing internet, and Tim Berners-Lee realised they could share information by exploiting an emerging technology called hypertext.
Oh, and it all sounds so long ago, but it's not. So in March 1989, Sir Tim Berners-Lee laid out his vision for what would become the web, in a document called Information Management, a Proposal. Sounds so simple. But believe it or not, Tim's initial proposal was not immediately accepted. In fact, his boss at the time, Mike Sendell, noted the words vague but exciting on the cover. Bit of an understatement with hindsight. So even though the web was never an official CERN project, Tim's boss, Mike, still allowed Tim to work on developing the project. In September 1990, and by October 1990, only a month later, Tim had written three fundamental technologies that remain the foundation of today's web, and which you may have seen appear on parts of your web browser. So, first one's HTML. Paul might want to tell us what that stands for.
Yes, I never know. Hypertext markup language. Basically, the formatting language for the web.
The other one is URI.
Which is uniform...
Oh, URL, sorry.
Yeah.
Oh, no, actually, it is URI. Yeah.
It is URI. Uniform Resource Identifier, commonly called a URL, which is a kind of address that is unique and used to identify each resource on the web.
The other one is HTTP. Come on, Paul. Hypertext Transfer Protocol, which allows for the retrieval of linked resources from across the web. Wow. So Tim also wrote the first web page editor, come browser, worldwideweb.app, and the first web server, HTTPD. And by the end of 1990, the first web page was served on the open internet, and in 1991, people outside of the CERN organisation were invited to join this new web community. So you think it's not that long ago, 30 years or so, you know, 25. As the web began to grow, Tim realised that its true potential would only be realised if anyone anywhere could use it without paying a fee or having to ask for permission. That's a really important thing. Tim explained that had the technology been proprietary and in my total control, it would probably not have taken off. You can't propose that something be a universal space and at the same time keep control of it. So Tim and others made sure that CERN would agree to make the underlying computer code available on a royalty-free basis forever. This decision was announced in April 1993 and sparked a global wave of creativity, collaboration and innovation never seen before. In 2003, the companies developing new web standards committed to a royalty-free policy for their work. And by 2014, the year we celebrated the web's 25th birthday, almost 2 in 5 people around the world were using it. Tim moved from CERN to the Massachusetts Institute of Technology in 1994 to found the World Wide Web Consortium, which is known as W3C, which is an international community devoted to developing open web standards. He remains the director of W3C to this day. Well, I might have to check that up because this is an article I did quite a while back on the Science Show. But Tim was knighted by Queen Elizabeth II in the 2004 New Year Honours for services to the global development of the internet. And in 2009, Professor Sir Tim Berners-Lee went on to co-found the World Wide Web Foundation with Rosemary Leith. The Web Foundation is fighting for the web we want, a web that is safe, empowering and for everyone. What a story. Let us not forget the importance and where it all started.
Shattered glass, meaningless words, yellowed by time, faded photos exposing the pain, cellular leeches bleeding my mind.
Christ, you're finished!
Playing hangman, he casts the fateful dice, advise me this shroud shall not suffice.
A bit of Marillion there. We don't play that very often. The Web from 1983, because we're talking about a brief history of the World Wide Web. Just tuned in, of course, listening to the Live Science Radio Show here on Sheffield Live 93.2 FM, talking about science in all its different forms. Every Saturday, 11 until 12, we should have PG on the line. Good morning, Paul.
Good morning.
I'm not sure whether you could hear your intro there, a bit of bits and pieces, funnily enough.
Yeah, it was really what I found this week, I think, is bits and pieces. But maybe I can sign in on the World Wide Web.
Yes.
That you were talking about, because one of the things that sort of startled me this week is looking in Outlook to go to my emails, and they're flagging up a warning which says, just going to let you know that in future, if you don't actually go to a specific sign out for your emails or use a private browser, you remain signed in.
Ah.
Which, again, looking around what's happening, they're preparing for possible legislation here in the UK because they're trying to bring things under control. And it's kind of now how the original idea, I think, with Tim Berners-Lee was to share information openly. And now we're looking for ways to control.
Yeah, control it now, yes.
Information sharing. And it's not always that obvious. So at the moment, a great article from Chris Stokel-Walker about millions of users at risk of fraud from data gathered by widely known apps. And it says that some of the most high-profile apps are those where they insist that you enter your location. And if you leave on your location, then it's stored in lots and lots of data stores and cross-referenced and analysed to find out all sorts about you. So a breach of the US data location company Gravy Analytics, which brokers information for more about 10,000 popular apps, and they're things like Vinted, Spotify, Candy Crush, Tinder, BBC News, Sky Sports News, and there are lots of things there that if you've got a smartphone, there's a 100% chance your location has been transferred to a company like Gravy Analytics. And if you actually look now, a lot of the times you'll get to where you think you want to be, and it'll suddenly pop up and say, oh, can you just tick this box to say you're fine with us sharing information? And if you want to take the time out and go through the partners and the additional interests that are listed there, you'll find hundreds of companies like this one that basically deal with your data. And the problem is that if you give that open permission, they can openly use your data, and they'll argue that basically that's not personalised. But it does actually give an awful lot of information about you and what you're doing. So on this article, they spoke to a French ethical hacker and it's a company called Predictor Labs, which works to safeguard individuals. And they're hacking the data of somebody like Gravy Analytics. It opens up a cornucopia of information about people. So I think I mentioned the other week about your smart devices at home, and a lot of things like your TV ask you for your postcode to sign in. Signing into the BBC want your postcode. Signing into a lot of the apps on your TV, they want your postcode. So you start to see that they can sell advertising information by putting people geographically in groups and clusters, which is valuable to marketing and trying to promote things. So you've got this company, sort of Gray Analytics is one of the information brokers, but also you've got companies like Tinder, which are having direct relationships with that company, and Vinted, and Flight Radar 24. Now, there's been a lot of arguments about that, which is a live-streamed version of where flights are in the air with identification. And a lot of people with things like private jets have been very upset about that, because it does give sort of critical information for some things.
Yeah, it's an interesting one, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And so the location data services industry is being valued at something like $21 billion annually. And it's a massive sort of breach of security. So, people may or may not remember when Cambridge Analytics came to the fore with the American elections. And they were offering this kind of locational supplemented information out so that you could target people with particular promotions on political parties or individuals. And across Europe now, there are allegations of fixing of elections, but also there's this massive sort of push to break down data and feed it to the people that you think will be most responsive to receiving your message. So that's, you know, some of the most apparently innocuous things. Candy Crush is a game, if you're not familiar with it. And it's one of those things a lot of young people use, and again, sort of being able to physically locate that young user opens up lots of avenues for abuse. So realistically, it's fine getting into things. I think there's going to be a push to make it more difficult for you to not have a stronger security around your information. But so many of these analytical companies sit inside of things that you use as interested parties. And if you're not prepared to scroll through all of the things, because what happens is if you scroll through it, you'll usually find there's an on-off switch. And it says, you know, three companies will be turned off, and then the next one will be on. So there's not a blanket switch to say, please don't bother me with any of these. It's in one thing, it's a clarity and openness to say to people, look, you know, all these people are interested and involved, but strictly speaking, how many of us spend that time to go down the columns upon columns of users? You know, there can be literally hundreds attached to a site or to an app, and you're asked to go back in every time that you approach that site. So it's not something you say, oh, look, it's my preference, don't use any of those. It's, yeah, sorry, I don't want to do that, I don't want to do that. And if you don't go through the user sort of three sets of information that come up, which is directly interested parties, and they say, these are the cookies that we use to make your website work properly. And by the way, it's quite nice that we can see what you've been browsing and we can offer you information on things that we think you'd be interested in. But then behind that, you've got partners who are people that maybe appear on a retailer's website with their products. They're fed back information from your browsing and sort of view. But then you've got these interested parties that are added on as well. And there's this, I say, massively amount of money that's generated for these data analyst companies.
Yeah, so, it's an interesting one. I mean, even with technical documentation, you know, when you're doing an insurance policy or you're doing your car insurance, does anybody read 100 pages of all the small print? And it's only when you come to claim or, you know, and they say, well, didn't you read clause 999 on page? And people aren't going to do it, are they? And it's the same with apps, isn't it?
It's, well, you know, and they give you a sort of a simple no thank you button for some of the simple things. But then you suddenly find by scrolling through this, I say that the companies that you see, and they're across the globe. It's not as if they're sort of local UK companies. So your information is in this massive marketplace. And it's very, very difficult to keep that information away from the sort of world. So,
well, I think the part of it, Paul, is that apps generally are free, and the companies will argue, well, they're for free, and that's their payback, isn't it?
Absolutely.
Free marketing, you know, research.
Yeah. And, you know, I mean, some people say, I don't care. But increasingly, I say, we're also faced with stricter sort of rules on gaining access to your own information. Yeah, there's a lot of things. I mean, I've seen several cases recently of young people who've come to harm, and they're... parents have tried to access their online media use, and these companies, you know, the huge search engine companies, make it quite a difficult route for them to be able to say, well, you know, was there a trigger in what they were seeing on the internet that's caused them to self-harm in some way? And it's really... You know, the openness is one thing, and I guess that's the thing when we see the sort of rolling arguments with people like Elon Musk, who champion on one side of the thing that the openness on the internet, where it's a debating platform where you can say anything online, and basically people should be a bit more choosy about it if they don't like what they see, which... you know, that's why we're sort of around Europe, certainly. There's a lot of companies, a lot of countries looking at legislation about what you can and can't do. And I say the thing is, I mean, again, just looking at an article recently about millennials and how their views on the world have changed. And they now don't, you know, buy newspapers on a regular basis. A lot of their information is coming from online sources. There's an awful lot of things that are changing. They don't have a landline. It's all on their mobile. So, you know, that, again, is a massive sort of source of data for lots and lots of organisations to understand you, psychoanalyze you, and find out which strings to pull to make you go and buy whatever they're
exactly
selling.
And I find that most young people not only do not read you know, papers and books and things, if they're going to pay for anything, they're just going to do it on the phone.
Yeah,
which for me, my generation, I don't think I'd ever do that, but yeah, that's just normal. It becomes a norm, doesn't it?
That's what I say. I think, you know, we're talking about a 25-year period now, millennials, so the young adults, and they're moving forward. But yeah, wherever you travel, whatever you see, the number of times that you'll see a very young child being given a mobile phone or something to keep it occupied while you're travelling and things. you know, the provisioning cars for sort of data points where they can plug in and play games to keep them quiet when you're travelling to places. It's sort of becoming more of a norm. And I think the danger is that a lot of this is hidden so deeply that it can be missed and you don't realise what you're giving away.
No, so, indeed.
Yeah, and then... I guess just to sort of finalise and give you a bit of space, a wonderful story which I really loved was a story of Anish Ahmed, and he lives in Manipur in India, and as a young person he noticed that when a bird was eating things like guava and the seeds fell to the ground, later on, when it was fed with rainwater, then more trees grew. And he thought that was a wonderful thing. So today he's a 32-year-old environmentalist, and he's been involved in conservation efforts for over 10 years. And what he does, he uses a catapult and makes marble-sized seed balls made up of clay, soil, compost and seeds, goes and climbs to the top of a tree and fires them all around the place.
I like it.
It's a wonderful story, I think. Wow. And, you know, it's reseeding things where plants are perhaps not prospering. So and he works normally as an assistant teacher in a private school, but spends a major portion of his income safeguarding the environment and creating awareness among people. So travelled all over the place to distribute saplings during his holidays and weekends, and he thinks that he distributed more than 100,000 saplings to people across his state in the past 10 years. So where you think, you know, little things don't work, then some people, when they persevere, may come into something much better.
Amazing stuff. He's doing the job of a bird, because birds often spread seeds, as he noted, and some they left behind and some that got taken with them on the feet or the beaks or... Amazing stuff. Right, Paul, great stuff as usual. We'll speak to you Monday. Glory Days Rock Show, 1 till 3.
Great. Thank you,
Paul. Bye-bye, Paul. Bye.
Cheers. Bye. Bye. Bye.
Such a drive to want something sometime. One thing leads to another, I know. Was a time I wanted you for mine. Nobody knew. You arrived like a day, passed like a cloud. I made a wish, I said it out loud. Out loud in a crowd. Everybody else. Talk a good time. It's not my place to know what you feel. I'd like to know, but why should I? Who are you then? Who are you now? Well, come and maybe by night, you find a highbrow. Back in my room, I wonder that I sit on the bed and look at the sky. Up in the sky, how do you bang like the talk of the town? Maybe tomorrow, maybe someday. World. You've changed your place in this world. Oh, but it's hard to live by the rules. I never could and still never do.
Oh, talk of the town there by the Pretenders. We played that because our Paul was, well, talking, as he normally does, about bits and pieces, all good stuff.
Yes.
You're, of course, listening to the Life Science Radio Show here on Sheffield Live, 93.2 FM on digital, if you're in South Yorkshire, or sheffieldlive.org. Talking about science in all its different forms, and we should have Gareth Morgan on the line.
Camera.
Good morning, Gareth.
Good morning.
Oh, Happy New Year.
Happy New Year.
Seems incredible, doesn't it?
I was just saying off air, I can't believe that last time we spoke, you were talking about Christmas gift ideas.
I know.
And now here we are in a very cold and frosty January morning, indeed. I'm sure pretty good morning for photographing, do you think, or not?
It's a bit dull and grey at the minute.
Oh, we've got sunshine here in the middle of Sheffield. Shining upon us unusually.
It's probably heading your way. It's a bit grim where I am.
Oh dear. But for people who don't know who you are a member of and indeed ex-president of the Sheffield Photographic Society.
Yes,
indeed. One of the oldest photographic societies in the country, I think, if I recall.
In the world.
In the world, even. Wow.
1864 we started.
Good grief. And you're still going, well, you're going from strength to strength, and today you're going to talk about getting your photograph seen.
Yes, that's right. Because I think we've talked quite a lot about the what's and how's of photography, but never really why. Why do we take pictures? So I thought it might be worth talking about that a little bit today. And, you know, there are more photographs taken today than there ever have been.
Indeed.
But what do you do with them? And that's, I think, what, you know, you need to think about that. There's kind of a hierarchy. I mean, if you're just doing it to kind of inform your social media, that's fine. And that is a great place to get photographs seen, you know, whether it's Facebook, Instagram, Pinterest, or maybe even TikTok, although that may not be around for much longer. Ooh. If we follow the American example, you know.
I wonder where social media is going in its entirety, if I'm honest.
Well, there is, yeah, I mean, there's some fragmentation happening. It's kind of interesting that I guess the raison d'etre behind it is changing a bit as well. And I think people are beginning to trust it less because of AI and all sorts of things. But we're going to talk about that on a future date. So.
Yeah, that's an interesting one. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So I think the first point to think about, if you want to get your photographs out there, is to use social media. But I would say, think about what you're doing, because a lot of the stuff I see on social media, I don't know why people bother. It's so blurred and, you know, it's people's heads are cut off. And if you're going to put a photograph out there, at least make it a relatively good quality one.
Yeah.
You know, so think about what you're doing and make it at least cover the subject you're doing. And then that gives you a start point to get photographs out there. The kind of next level after the basic social media are things like photo sharing sites. So you've got things like Flickr, SmugMug, Pickfair, Pixabay, Zen Folio, 500px. There's lots of different ones out there. I guess Flickr is the one that everybody knows. And that's a great way, if you want people who are interested in photography to see your photographs, that's a great way to go. It's easy to set up an account. It's very easy to post. And you can get lots of pictures on there without having to pay a subscription or whatever. There are subscription models out there, but you know, you don't need to worry about that if all you're doing is looking to get that kind of basic coverage and get your pictures out there.
And also it's a link, isn't it, to share with people to say, if you're interested in my photographs, go and have a look at this place rather than, yeah.
And also it's an opportunity for you to see other people who've got similar interests. So you know I shoot a lot of street art. And in Flickr, there must be about, well, there's hundreds, but there's about a dozen really good people and groups who take street art all over the world, actually, but particularly in the UK. And what happens is you build up a little community. So when a new bit of street art pops up in Sheffield, for example, maybe not somewhere obvious, you can start to find clues of where it is, and people will... Very rarely do they tell you exactly where it is.
Yes.
Part of the fun is tracking it down. But, you know, if you know the group and you can start to build it up. And that's a great way of getting into interest groups and things that you're particularly interested in photographing. So I'm in a lot of street art groups. I'm in a lot of portrait groups that particularly black and white. You know, I like a lot of black and white photography. And we kind of share pictures and critique each other. People will, you know, look at my photographs and say, oh, that's great. It's just a pity you've got that, you know, bit of hair out of place. Or you've got that. You know, and you do get positive and sometimes negative feedback. You do sometimes get some odd comments, but that's the nature of social media. You can, you know, you cannot control what people are going to say, particularly when they're anonymous. You know?
Well, this is it. But I suppose you've seen a wider range of styles and innovation. Different people will come at the same subject as a completely different way, I guess.
And it kind of inspires you then to either, you know, kind of adopt those ideas or develop it and take it a bit further. Some people copy. I mean, you do see a lot of, somebody has a new idea and then you see loads and loads of it repeated. I like to kind of develop things and take them on a bit, but it's still a good place to start looking, and it's a good place to get your photographs out there. That kind of takes you then into non-photographic sites, but special interest. So I'm just thinking about particularly within Sheffield. We have people who are interested in bird photography, and they've now started working with the local branch of the RSPB to get their pictures, you know, either on the RSPB site locally, or quite often, in fact, several of them go and give talks every year to the local branch, and on, you know, pictures they've taken that year of different birds. We've got another guy who's into rock climbing. In fact, he's really into mountaineering. He's been, you know, he's been to the foothill of the Himalayas. He's been to base camp on Everest. He's been all over the Alps, as well as climbing in the Peak District nearly every week. The thing he does is he takes pictures all the time while he's climbing, takes pictures of his friends while they're climbing. And he's built up a huge portfolio now of climbing photographs that the climbing magazines and websites love.
Really? Also, there's money potentially to be made as well, I guess.
There is. I was going to kind of come into that. I mean, it is a way of making money. It's not a way of making a lot of money.
No, like most things these days, unfortunately.
Well, that's the trouble with everybody having a mobile phone. It's, you know, there are hundreds of good pictures out there, because even with a mobile phone, you can get great pictures these days. So you are competing against a much bigger market, but you can carve out a little niche. One of the girls in the club, you know, a few years ago, started taking wildlife pictures and really got into it and started publishing, entering competitions, and ended up got spotted, and she won a national wildlife competition and ended up on Look North TV.
Wow.
Just for like, you know, 30-second thing about it, which led to other things. Now, last year, she gave up work. She started her own business. It's called Wild Apertures. And she's leading photographic tours in Africa, India.
Oh, my
words. I've been on one in Scotland. This week, she's in London judging another wildlife photography competition. And she's, you know, she's actually turned that into a business that's making a reasonable income for her. And she's doing something she loves, which is... it's kind of important.
That's a real inspirational story for the new year, actually, because, yeah, you know, sometimes you do follow, to get a job that you actually love and it's based around what you know, your hobby or your passion is, that's very lucky, isn't it?
It's true. It's true. I mean, as we're on that subject, I mean, there's another guy in the club who's, he owns a small cafe, and upstairs he had a big empty room, which he's turned into a studio. And he's now in the process of thinking, you know, should he develop that as his business?
Wow.
He started to do photography for people, and he's shooting things for, you know, Instagram influencers, what pictures taken. And again, you're not making huge amounts of money, but you can make a reasonable income if you go down that road.
And you're doing what you enjoy doing. That's the thing, isn't it?
Yeah. So, and that, you know, for me, that's great. I think I'm too old and too long in the tooth to go down that road now.
Yeah, but if you're a little bit younger and you just come, you know, and you can mix the best of both worlds, because I've noticed a lot of cafes, places, bars, they've got a lot of art on the walls, not just painted art, but photographic art, and they sort of put local artists up and sell it, so it becomes a bit self-perpetuating.
Yeah, it does, and it's a way of getting into, I mean, the one thing I was going to want to talk about was, you know, join your local camera club. That gets you into printing if they're interested in those sort of exhibitions, competitions. Once you start printing things, it takes you into whole other areas. Although I don't do a lot of it, I do sell prints. You know, particularly after exhibitions, you get people asking. And I've done a few commission pieces, which it's pocket money, but it pays for my next lens.
Well, this is it. And you're getting somebody else's appreciating what you're doing, because it's a very personal thing, I think, photography.
It is. And it's, I mean, I like to get my work out there because I guess I'm quite proud of it and I like to show off a bit. So, you know, it's it may not be everybody's cup of tea, but it's a great way to get, you get feedback, you get it seen. It's quite rewarding to do it that way, really.
Yeah, I mean, to be fair, you said this year at your annual perspective exhibition, which is Winter Gardens every year, you said it was a different, you got asked more questions by people coming to see the pictures. I'm trying to remember what you said.
Yeah, just more, I think people are thinking more about their own photography. And that's partly what spurred the idea. As you know, we're running an open photography competition ourselves at the moment, which we haven't done for 50 years. I think the club used to do it, but
wow.
You know, this is the first time. And it's interesting to see some of the stuff that's coming in is really good. I mean, you know, obviously very experienced photographers. Others, I suspect they're just starting out, but it's just interesting to see. And we'll get those, you know, we're going to keep it going till the end of February. And then we'll get them, pick the winners out, and we'll get them printed and included in our exhibition at the Cathedral in April, which will be, or the end of April, May, whenever it is. So, you know, and that's something you can look at, competitions. The Star and Telegraph have competitions regularly, which, you know, you can get into, and small prizes, but you're getting your work seen and you're getting feedback, and that's what it's all about. Right?
Yeah, I noticed you got a big article in the Sheffield Telegraph, didn't you, about that competition?
Yeah, because we'd been talking to them about it and about publicising it, and we were debating whether to take an advert in the paper, because, you know, we want to get as many people to participate as possible. But it costs money that
it
way.
It does, so yeah.
We often put our competition pictures. The Telegraph like to publish some of our best work. So we said this month, why don't you put some of these in? And they were really quite, you know, supportive about it. And they got on board. We've now got Harrison's Cameras supporting us. They're going to donate the prizes. And I think they're publicising it to their, you know, their clientele base online. Because they used to run an excellent series of photographic competitions, which I don't think they've done for a little while. So they're quite happy to jump on this one as well.
It's maybe, do you think it's something that maybe would have been done for Harrison Cameras, but would have been done pre-COVID? And maybe that stopped.
Yeah.
It stopped a lot of things, didn't it? But yeah it I did. Think I mean, it's great, yeah.
Yeah, because they did it, I think, a couple of years before I actually won the annual one and got a new camera out of it.
Did so, you? Know, you get, oh, yeah. I say. Oh, wow. It's very interesting. It's amazing. I mean, Harrison Cameras, it's on London Road, isn't it?
It is.
It's been there forever. For as long as I can ever remember, and it still remains there, which is tremendous considering.
Yeah, and it's a proper camera shop.
It's a proper,
and, you know, it really does have all that you need to. Every aspect of photography is covered, and it's been around as long as I can remember. I can remember going in when Ron Harrison was around, and you know, talking, and you can go in and just have a chat with the guys and they'll give you advice, and they prefer it if you buy stuff.
Well, of course, yeah, but you know what I'm saying, with a shop like that's a traditional, camera place, it's still going despite mobile phones and da-di-da and everybody changing. Are they, do you think they're realising there's slowly a turnaround and people are now getting more interested in photography and traditional style cameras, even though they're more modern digital?
Yeah, I mean, last time I was in, they had a big display of print cameras, retro. I think the good thing about them is they keep the finger on the pulse.
Yeah.
So they know what the trends are, particularly in the photography business. So, they're pretty astute at that sort of thing. So, I mean, I'm hoping they'll be around for
forever.
A long time forever.
Yeah.
I use them a lot.
It's interesting. So, you know, out of this open competition then, maybe from in future years, when people get the idea that it's ongoing, what's been the mix of entries? Has it been people using traditional, like digital SLRs, or has it been mobile phone pictures, or has it been a bit both?
It's been mainly, not necessarily SLRs, but mainly digital cameras. So there's been some point-and-shoot cameras, because you can tell from the EXIF, which is the information on attached to the image. There's a couple of mobile phone shots, in fact, quite a few, but I would say most of them are taken in some form of digital camera.
Yeah. And would you say I've seen some of the subject matter, because I've seen it on social media, on your Facebook page, Sheffield Photo Society page, but is it a real mix? It seems
it's
to be.
It's quite a mix. There's quite a lot of Sheffield pictures, which is interesting, because we didn't put a theme. We said it's open, take what you want. But people are sending, I guess, not surprising, but they've taken the photographs in Sheffield, so they are of Sheffield things. There's quite a bit of landscape, a little bit of wildlife. Not as many people photographs as I'd expected. I thought we'd see more people.
Ah, well, maybe, you know, we live in a world where you've got to be careful taking pictures of people without permission, whereas way back, you know, on that note, we are running out of time, sadly, but, you know, there isn't somebody else in your club who's just won another competition, and that was all black and white photography. It was like old pictures of children on streets.
Yes.
And obviously that was back in a time when having your picture taken by somebody would have been glorious. Taking that for.
1975, those pictures were taken
Were they all Sheffield?
They were all South Yorkshire, I think.
Were they? And what was that competition then?
It's a competition that we have every year in the club called the Kendoni, which is for, it's six pictures on a theme. People put in different. I put in six pictures of dogs this year for some reason and didn't do very well.
You didn't win because I've noticed you've changed your Facebook cover page. Is that photo one of the photographs he took?
Yes.
But so you have to say you a bit about people photography. You put dogs in.
I did. Well, I thought they'd know it. They always know it's me because they know my sort of portrait photography. So I thought I'd give them a surprise this year. And put some dogs in, which it did okay. People really liked it, but, you know, it wasn't as strong as the winning.
No, but it's brilliant. Those old photographs, you know, when you have your exhibitions, there's always some of the old photographs of Sheffield, and they're absolutely fascinating, as they are of any city or place, aren't they, when you see it?
Well, it's social history. And,
it is.
You know, recent. It's in our lifetime, so it makes you think about things.
Yeah. Fantastic stuff, Gareth. We could carry on talking for ages, but I'm afraid the film's showing after us. So thanks ever so much, Gareth.
All right,
speak soon. Bye-bye. Bye. 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 Bye.